3, 2, 1, go!
Welcome back, everybody, to the Triad of the Force podcast, a podcast from Puerto Rican friends coming together to do deep dives into Star Wars and other nerd-related media. Today, we're talking about The Mandalorian, chapters 20 and 21, The Foundling and The Pirate. We are very sorry that we had kind of an impromptu hiatus there, but I mean, Goose is changing jobs, I'm in law school, life happens, and
it was your birthday, really, happy birthday. Yeah.
And it was my birthday weekend, so celebrations must be had.
And it's appropriate, as we head towards Star Wars Celebration, that we celebrate not just that, but the other parts of our life that make us who we are. So happiest of birthdays, Nani. I hope it was a very, very good one and a happy one and a joyful one filled with love and the people that you love and love you back. I'm very sad that I couldn't join you. Sorry, my accent creeped up there.
Pierce the veil.
Pierce the veil. But I hope it was fun. I hope you had a good time.
It was nice.
New beginnings. Like every birthday should be like a moment to be like, hey, let's reevaluate life a little bit.
And I'm starting a new decade in my life.
I've heard that new decade is like the new old decade. I'm not gonna be saying what decades we're talking about because that's not polite. But I've heard that it's better. I've heard that it's better.
Well, for good things coming. You're going to be on your way to London in a couple of days. Mm-hmm. I'm so sad that I'm not going to be able to make it again.
You will be there in spirit. And next time, like for the sense, celebrations taking a break next year gives us time to, you know, get our ducks in
plan
order.
Plan for the
next one. Hey, we'll see where it is. I've heard some rumors of where it might be. Which, you know, I can't reveal here. So
hopefully
we'll
I'll be done with school by then and have already
hopefully
passed
you'll
the bar.
Hopefully I'll be done, pass the bar, and be able to go to Star Wars Celebration 2025. Hopefully we'll all be there. Hopefully we can all be there.
Hopefully.
Because
and regardless of
so
that,
much fun.
Yeah, just I recommend everybody that's going to be there, go to all the panels that the Triad is involved and all of our other friends. And there's going to be like great guests that are going to help us out there because, you know, I can't make it, but I think it's going to be fantastic. I think there's going to be some really great conversations and celebration is going to be great, but we're going to be the best part of it.
This is going to be a good one. Obviously, we're talking about The Mandalorian here, but since we haven't had like a regular episode in a while, I figure we maybe talk about that a little bit for anyone that's like joining us back after our unscheduled hiatus that we didn't even acknowledge on social media. But if you've been following us on the Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Hive, if anyone remembers what Hive is, we will be part of two. We will be part of two panels. Obviously, our own panel, as Triad of the Force, joined by our very good friend Alden Diaz and Cari Guerrero, aka Star Wars Tia, where we shall be discussing what it means to be like, what is the reckoning, the Latina reckoning that we are currently living through in a post Andor world, like, especially look through the lens of the three main Latina actors that are currently leading the live action series for Disney Plus and Star Wars, which is obviously Diego Luna as Cassian Andor, Pedro Pascal as Din Djarin, The Mandalorian, and Rosario Dawson as Ahsoka Tano. So through those three particular lenses, we'll see like what that means for the Latina experience. So it's going to be a fun one. Obviously, there's some connective tissue to like our panel last year and to the other panel that I will be hosting because I'm taking the reins from Andres Cabrera on the Latinx representation panel, which we will also have a slew of awesome guests, including as well Cari Guerrero. And that one will be more general, broad in scope, where we will just be generally talking about Latinx representation, what it means to us, and all those good things. So thematically, they're similar because we're talking about Latinx representation.
The fact that Latinas are awesome. We're awesome.
And we're taking over the world. You see the Blue Beetle trailer? That looks awesome. Similar but different because it's going to be different points of view. So just because you saw the one doesn't mean you don't get to see the other. Go to both. They're on Sunday. Triad of the Force at 4 to 5. And then Latinx representation, I think, is 6 to 7. Confirm that on the Star Wars Celebration app. be there or be square. And then, you know, if you see me on the show floor, don't hesitate to say hi. I have pins. I have stickers. They're free. I don't want to come back.
Joy.
I don't want to come back to Chicago with them. Take them out of my hands, please. What else? We'll be hanging out, obviously, on Friday. We are doing the queer meetup with Chase, a.k.a. That Gay Jedi. And don't only go there to have drinks with us, but also be sure to go to Chase's panel on Saturday.
I forgot the time, but
it's gonna be incredible. Let's show them a huge amount of support because they have gotten a lot of vitriol online from very toxic and
completely
completely underserved vitriol from like a very small group of toxic people that are, you know, bigots. So let's make sure that like the voices of compassion and inclusivity are louder than that. But
they're to
that
cheer. Being
said, yeah. Let's make it about love and inclusion, people. But that being said, we're excited for Celebration. We're excited for all the announcements that they are going to present at the showcase. There's a lot of it's going to probably be surprises that we are not even aware about. But other than that, you know, Celebration is cool, but it's always about the people. So more than the panels, I'm very excited to meet up with old friends, make some new friends and, you know, experiences and see a new city, right? Because I've never been to London. Have you been to London?
I have not. I'm very sad.
Well, you've traveled. I don't know.
I have. But anyway, this is all very actually relevant to The Mandalorian because now we live in Pedro Pascal's world.
Yes, we do.
That is life right now. And I have been really enjoying The Mandalorian. I don't understand how it's getting hate and how it's just not being lauded is just incredibly amazing, especially how it has become something completely different from what it was before and how it's so much more captivating than season two was and how you don't really expect what's coming in every episode. Mm-hmm. So then all the threads that are getting interwoven and how the story is building and the tension in every single episode. I'm like at the edge of my seat in every single episode, aside from the fact that it's still incredibly visually stunning and the music is insane and all the acting is just like
top notch.
Has been elevated with every episode. So the last two just honestly keep surprising me. Katie O'Brien is kicking it out of the park.
She's a queen. Thank God. I was so interested in her character like in season two. So I'm very happy that she's getting the time to shine and like be. I mean, obviously, I would prefer if she were a good guy, but she's killing it as a bad guy. It's incredible.
And I have to say that I was completely wrong because I kind of thought it was a double bluff thing that she was doing. And it's like, nope, Goose was right. She's totally working for Moff Gideon. It's totally happening. And she's so great at the passive aggressiveness. It's insane.
Although, I mean, we'll go in order, right? Because we have to talk about the Foundling first. But I was a little flabbergasted. Let's use the big words. I was a little flabbergasted that we didn't really address Pershing's mind being fried.
Blade.
I mean, I'm sure it'll come up, right? We're not going to just... I hope that that's not going to just be abandoned and we're going to see an aftermath of that. But I was surprised that there wasn't like, hey, like, what happened with this dude? And she just gets to work normal when she was the last person to be with him before his mind got flayed or fried or whatever you want to say it. But we'll get to that because also that episode was so incredible because we had the return of Carson Teva, which is, you know, awesome to see, and other legacy characters from animated shows.
I know.
We'll get
to
that.
That's really insane.
But let's start with the Foundling. We go back to the Mandalorian covert and we see how Bo-Katan is dealing with being part of the Children of the Watch, and you know, shenanigans ensue, flashbacks are revealed, answers are given. Really good action set pieces, interesting character relationships. So Nani, what did you think of the Foundling?
Yeah, overall, I mean, first off, I'm just thinking the whole entire time, why did the Mandalorians pick this place? They have giant, massive alligators trying to eat your children and then dragon-like birds just, you know, taking them to their nests to feed their children. I mean, could they have not picked a planet with, you know, maybe less active apex predators?
Maybe that was on purpose. Maybe that was their point. It's just like, okay, well, if this is dangerous for us and we're Mandos,
people won't
it's
come.
Gonna be exactly. It's going to be dangerous for other normies that can't fight as good as we can. So maybe that was maybe that was them playing like a fourth dimensional chess.
But I'm pretty sure that a few kids were lost before that one that was finally saved. Like there was mentions of
survival of the fittest. Maybe they're like Spartans.
And they're Mandalorians. You know? They're Mandalorians.
Yeah. Like Spartans, you know, the Spartans used to sacrifice the young that can't survive. Maybe that's their jam. I don't know. I hope not. I hope that they're a little nicer to their savage. Kids. But
it was really interesting to see Bo-Katan kind of trying to find her way within this community that she's been. It's an extreme version of a community that she already kind of shunned because she thought that they were, even the regular Mandalorians were kind of extreme. This cult version obviously is extra extreme. So to see her kind of navigate how to fit in there. And I was ecstatic about the fact that it's combining Star Wars with high fantasy dragons and stuff. So I'm getting the best of like sci-fi and Star Wars and, you know, fantasy, and it just tickled my fancy. I thought it was wonderfully done, and it's so cool, especially when you see like the limitations to the Mandalorians, because you have this mountain. It's like, why can't I use the jetpacks? Oh, because they're too loud. You have to like actually climb, and you can see that they're not completely reliant on their equipment. Their equipment makes them that much better, but they're the underlying base. Without that extreme amount of training that they already have, the armor is useless. So it calls into seeing how the Mandalorians are so much more than just the Beskar. Mm-hmm. And I love seeing that. And I love the relationships. And I love seeing the soft side of Paz Vizsla, which I was never expecting.
He's a daddy. Not a daddy like Pedro, but a daddy like in the actual literal sense.
This is really going to pay off eventually because, as soon as you see that it was his kid that got saved, you're like, you just made an ally for life here. And this is going to be instrumental in the long run, I feel like. What did you feel about the episode?
I said it before. I'll say it again. I was not a fan of season. I mean, I liked season two, but I just didn't like
the structure. But all things considered.
But I wasn't a big fan of the structure of season two because I felt it was too fragmented in terms of like how I was presenting the narrative. And obviously, yes, it did push the plot forward, but in a way, it just felt like too adventure of the week type of thing where everything's a little too self-contained. Like obviously now with season three, we're kind of seeing some of the payoffs of a lot of that in terms of like how we're bringing like all those different adventure of the weeks into like one cohesive narrative. But season three is really doing it for me because it's giving me exactly what I want as a Star Wars fan. It's like the opposite of Andor to an extent, where Andor was giving me exactly what I didn't know I wanted. Like Mandalorian is giving me everything I wanted because it's just like unbridled joy and unapologetically Star Wars and just embracing all the things that are joyous of Star Wars and taking all the deep cuts of mythic things from the expanded universe and obviously animated parts and then bridging the gap with the sequels and then taking things from the prequels. And it's just like it's a smorgasbord of delightfulness. And before we get into like the my favorite part of that episode, like everything you were saying about the Mandalorian covert was excellent, particularly because how you get to see like more of their interior dynamics of how they work as a unit, because we always see Mandalorian since Boba Fett was introduced, like the lone gunsman. Lone
ranger,
The lone gunslinger, lone gunsman, whatever you want to call it. When we see Mando in season one, he's also by himself. We see Mandalorians as a group, like in Clone Wars and whatnot. But this episode, at least to me, really hammered home like the sense of community that the Mandalorians have. Yep. And like how...
I mean, and even in animation, Sabine was like exiled from her family, and you see her by herself as well. Yeah. So even though we know that that family structure is there, and we do have a few episodes with her like biological family, her family's really with the ghost. So it's been rare to see like Mandalorians actually working together.
And to the extent that we see here in terms of like how accepting they are of each other. And I'll get to, because I also do have some issues with that, and we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
But like it was it's really interesting to see then like how accepting they are of others to an extent, right? Because with Bo-Katan, we saw in the previous episode that they accepted her because she bathed in the waters of the mines of Mandalore, and like now she's part of the covert, and like no questions asked. It's just like, oh, you like
you're
redeemed, so you're in, and we're gonna follow you and like trust you, because he led the expedition to save what's the kid's name? It's he has a cool name actually.
The Vesla kid.
You're always the one that remembers the names, Nani.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm failing.
Oh my god, we've been out for a minute. Now we're failing. Ragnar.
And now we're failing. Ragnar.
Thank you, Wikipedia. Leading the charge to rescue Ragnar and like coming up with the plan. And Paz Vizsla, however you want to say it, just trust her. It's just like, okay, we'll follow your lead, even though you're new here, right? Yeah. But still, we're gonna trust you. And then
I mean, Bo-Katan does have legit credentials.
I don't know for shizzles, but because she wasn't walking the path.
I know.
They could have been like, oh, you still need to kind of prove yourself to us a little bit because you just got here. He just got here. We don't know you. But that was great to see. But also the acceptance towards Grogu. Because they could, Bo-Katan was like outside of their group because she didn't walk the quote unquote path. But she's still a human, you know, she's still wearing the armor, all this thing. So in a way, it's easier to have that acceptance. But Grogu is completely... Yeah. Alien, right, to them, a completely different species, different size, different skill sets. He's technically he is Jedi, so he fights different, but they, even though Jedi are technically the enemies of the Mandalorian, they still accept him. To see them being like, okay, he can do it, and to see Paz in that scene be like, one does not speak unless one knows, and like recognize that when Grogu is able to trust himself and beat Ragnar was a really nice moment, especially when we see like the father son aunt and nephew relationship between Din and Bo-Katan with him. It's like, just trust yourself, come on man, we trust you.
You can do it.
Like, we trust you, so you can trust yourself. So sweet. What did you think of all that, like Grogu?
It was something that I didn't know that I need, but I needed it. I mean, I've loved from the beginning that it's so accepting, like Din at first, that he just refers to him as a foundling, like, you're a Mandalorian, our people, this is where we come from. And now coming into the covert, it's like, yeah, all the rules of being a foundling apply to you as well. Just because he's small doesn't mean that he can't play by the rules. And it's parenting that we need to see more, because I think a lot of the times what we see is like overprotection and try to like underestimating your children instead of like giving them the support that they actually need to be their better selves, which is what we were seeing here. It's like, you know, you can do this because we've seen you and we believe you can do this, and you can rely on your own strengths and you can rely on us and our support. And if you can't do it, you can't, but you have to at least try.
But the flip side of that, though, is to some extent, it felt to me that Din was forcing him to do it. It's like the parent that was a sports star when they
trying
were
trying too hard.
School.
It's like, you have to get all the
right,
goals.
Right. Like, I was great at sports. So like, you're going to be great at sports, and kind of forces a kid to do something, even though maybe that's not what the kid wants to do. So that's not necessarily the case here, but I also think there's another side to that where like a parent also has to recognize the path that the kid wants to take, and maybe that path is not the one that you think they need to take.
But Grogu did choose to be a Mandalorian.
He shows his dad.
True.
I don't know. I don't know if it's mutually exclusive, but there might be nuance.
And I agree with you, because I still have an issue with, and I think that's why the show is so good, because it doesn't immediately make you think of the covert as the enemy. You're starting to see them more as like real people, even though there's still all the sketchy elements of it behind. So that complexity adds a lot of layers to what's happening in the story right now. Like, you don't really know where they're going with.
How do you feel about that? How do you feel about that? Because I wanted to touch on that. I feel like right now they've been normalizing the cult and now making it seem like cults aren't that bad. And I'm just like, is that what I mean? Yeah, it's badass, everything that they've been doing so far. And like, you are rooting for them. But in the back of my mind, I was like, oh, wait, but like, they're, you know, they calling someone from your in-group an apostate just because like they don't do like the one thing. Yeah. It's never a good thing because that's how families are destroyed. Like, you know, an apostate is a very toxic word that has destroyed families and relationships in cults, like in real life cults. So like to now kind of brush that aside a little bit and be like, oh, well, you know, but look at, you know, but they have a sense of community. Yeah, that's how cults get you. So they so give I'm you that sense of that, community. So it's just like,
I'm hoping they're not trying to normalize the cult aspect of, because it's been very icky for me from the beginning, especially when we see like Bo-Katan being like seduced by it. So I mean, this calls into the second episode, the pirate, as well, because we see that. I'm kind of hoping that Bo-Katan is faking the amount of devotion that she's been showing for the covert, and she's just. I didn't want her to be the bad guy, but now I'm just kind of, I would rather her be using the covert for her own ends than to actually be seduced by the, come here, it will give you the Kool-Aid, you know?
Right.
So.
Well, it's odd because, and I'm pretty sure that we'll definitely get answers to like all these questions that we're raising. Yeah. But it's interesting, especially when we do that duality of, and obviously we're skipping forward a little bit, but we're keeping it in terms of like the Mando narrative, and then themes, we can talk about the other outside Mando stuff from the both episodes. But when you compare the last scene in that in the Foundling, when like Bo-Katan is telling the armorer about seeing the Mythosaur, and then the scene when like they're in the dark in the old covert in Navarro, and like Bo-Katan's in the light, the armorer's in the dark. And she's like, remove your helmet. Do you trust in my station? All that stuff. And so in that first part in the Foundling, like it feels like
she was using that information to her benefit. Like, I saw the Mythosaur.
Where she's I'm the second coming of Mandalore. She's putting all those pieces together to be like, okay, well, these are the things I need to do. And I just need to figure out like what mythic legend or whatever will validate my claim to the throne, and that's why I'm trusting,
and at what times to use that information correctly for better benefits.
Exactly.
Yeah, so,
but in the next episode, in the pirate, when she's talking to the armorer, it was interesting to see Bo-Katan's hesitation and kind of nervousness to one, remove her helmet, and then to kind of accept the station that that the armorer is giving her. So it's two different sides of Bo-Katan that I think are very interesting, and it makes me kind of not be sure of what direction she's going in, right? Because it's just like, wait, is she playing like the cards for her to be the ruler of Mandalore, or was she actually drinking
Kool-Aid? Or is she
actually
buying into the court? The cult. I can't decide.
I don't know.
And there was some heavy like breathing there at the end when she was looking at the armor. Like, I don't know if she's just crushing on the armor now too. That's a possibility. Who knows?
The armor gonna remove her helmet?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, and thinking about Bo-Katan this way, I mean, she's been alone now for so long, and she's failed so many times at trying to bring her people together. And she's kind of just never really been acknowledged for the leader that she could be. And now I think having this sort of validation from somebody who's so respected by her community, like the armorer, I think it might actually be really affecting Bo-Katan. So
it's interesting.
She is only human too.
She is only human. But it's still interesting that then Din still has the Darksaber and everyone's kind of ignoring him.
I know.
So it's just like, wait, we've already established through not just Rebels, but even within the show narrative that whoever wins the Darksaber in combat can unite the Mandalorians and be the leader. So technically, that's Din, and he's been for a minute, you know, and no one's giving two shits about him. So it's just like, okay, what's the play here? Like, because honestly, I'm on team. I want Bo-Katan to rule Mandalore. I don't want it to be Din because she's worked for it. She deserves it. Like,
she deserves it.
Let's give a woman a chance.
And I don't think he wants it anyway.
He's a Jon Snow, right? But I don't want them to do the Game of Thrones thing where it's just like, okay, well, the woman that's actually like a person that's worthy and who actually would be better
deserves it. Know what she's doing.
We're gonna either kill her or be like, oh no, she's crazy.
Make her the bad guy.
Right, make her. I don't want
or make her the bad guy
because it didn't work in Game of Thrones. Yeah. I don't want it to be a thing here in Star Wars. So we'll need to see. We'll need to see, and we will see. Obviously, like it's like this season as opposed to season two really has given me a lot more certainty that they know where they're going, like with the story, especially because of the story structure of the season so far. It's a little more conventional than the previous two seasons in terms of like they're, you know, telling a more linear narrative as opposed to the more episodic nature of the previous seasons. But it's really working for me because it's kind of giving me the information. That linear aspect of the season so far. it's doing it, and I don't know, I appreciate it.
I do too, actually. I'm finding it very enjoyable.
But before we go into like more things from
the pirate
where that actually pushes a lot of narrative forward, there's the one scene in The Foundling that not only broke my mind, broke the mind of the internet, and was a beautiful moment for fans, both young and old, and it was a thing that made everyone cheer, I think, and it was the answer of who rescued Grogu. I remember when there were the theories that the flashback, that the lightsaber sequences in the Jedi Temple from the trailers were when the Mandalorians were breaking the Darksaber out, more than likely it was going to be Grogu's rescue, and that's what eventually it was. But to see who that person was, when that elevator opened up and I saw Ahmed Best, I was over the moon. I'm like, fuck,
yes.
Like, yes. There, the sabered hand, Kelleran Beck, is here.
The sabered hand.
What? How did you feel when you saw Ahmed Best be the person that rescued Grogu?
Oh my god, I could not believe it. We've been speculating about this so much ever since the first season, and we never knew. I mean, I think a lot of us, at least I was like a little upset. It's like, I don't want to go back to Order 66.
It's enough pain. Enough pain. Yeah.
Already enough PTSD about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see that it's Kelleran.
What a beautiful moment. Oh my god. Lots of people have been saying that it's redemption for Ahmed Best. I'm not one of those. The man does not need redemption. Like, he did his job. Like, if anyone needs redemption, it's like all the fans that treated him like shit. But it was a beautiful moment of catharsis to, like, you know, see him come back in a glorious moment. It's just like, hey, like, let's bring you back into Star Wars and be like, hey, let's give you this.
Be the hero that saved. The hero.
And to an extent, like, and we'll speculate about this a little bit, it kind of feels like Ahmed did double duty in terms of rescuing Grogu, because when we see Kelleran go in one of those swoop bikes, I love seeing like all the Clone Wars era stuff, like,
I know,
in live action again. But when he goes to the Naboo cruiser, it's just like, there's only, in my mind, there's only one or two people that sent that ship. And it wasn't Padme, because Padme had no clue what was happening at the Jedi Temple, because we see in Revenge of the Sith that she was just like, oh my god, Annie, are you okay? So
Jar Jar himself sent the
ship. The other person that has a Naboo cruiser himself is Jar Jar Binks. So, like, Jar Jar, wouldn't that be amazing that Ahmed Best is part of the two characters?
Double hero.
The two characters that were involved in the rescue of Grogu. That just blows my mind. And it's just like such it's also like a big middle finger to all the Jar Jar haters as well, and be like, hey, yeah, you know what? Jar Jar rescued Grogu. He sent the ship. to get one of your new favorite characters.
They're full of shit as well, because when everybody was a kid and the prequels came out, all of us loved Jar Jar.
Well, I don't know if I loved him that much when it came out, but I've learned to, I just accept it. And now I have a Black Series figure of Jar Jar that I was one of my favorites, and I'm ready to have Ahmed Best sign. But it was, and to see like all the Naboo security guards, like in all.
Yes. It's so prequels. It's so much prequel goodness.
So good, and see the V-wings and stuff. I'm like, man. You're doing it, John Favreau.
And it is what you mentioned before. It's Mando's doing so much to bridge the prequels, the originals, and the sequels. We've seen things from all of the three trilogies, and it's amazing. And they add a lot of the animated stuff, which we hadn't really seen before, and successfully adding them in.
Successfully. Wait till we get to that.
I know!
That was also like a what a jaw dropping moment.
That was a what? We paused. We were like yelling.
It's like, is that? Is that?
Is that? Is that? But no, it was fantastic. I do love your idea of the fact that he himself could have been both characters that saved Grogu, but I'm still sticking to my gums that it was probably not him because he is Darth Jar Jar and he's always been.
He's not Darth Jar Jar. I mean, that's a cool theory, but he's not. He's,
I know.
Jar Jar Binks is is a beacon of light. He's a good person.
Impurity.
Through and through. Through and through.
Yeah. No, but those scenes were gorgeous because it's a scene that we've seen a million times, but it actually seemed different. It felt like you were getting it from a different angle and an actual successful rescue and not just the death of younglings. And
Kylo Ren is still alive, which I was glad for. It's not that he rescued him and then died. And did you ever
the
watch
double wielding and everything?
Did you ever watch the Jedi Temple Challenge show on YouTube? It was, obviously it's a kid's show, but I loved it a lot because growing up, I was a big fan of Legends of the Hidden Temple.
I love that show.
That was one of my favorite kid game shows.
It was a version of that with Star Wars?
It was a version of that with Star Wars. Yeah.
I didn't know that even existed.
And then Ahmed Best, that's the first time that Ahmed Best was actually Kylo Ren Beck.
Oh.
So he's like the host of the show, but he's Jedi Master Kylo Ren Beck, the Saber Hand. And he's he's the one that takes all the kids through all the challenges and stuff. It's a really wholesome show, So in that sense, it really makes sense that Kylo Ren.
Oh, but that adds so much more to the story because I didn't know that. So
and exactly, it kind of strengthens.
Thank you for enlightening me.
It's right for him to rescue Grogu because it's
perfect.
Because Kylo Ren has always been the teacher that cares about the younglings. So it's like he's always did that. So he's so good, so good. I love. We want to see more. Oh, and his robes.
Oh yeah, his robes.
So good with like. They had like all the gold embellishments, which for me is just like, are those like Ahmed Best said that like he was involved with the design with the costume designers to like put his
with all the designs on the collar.
So it has to do with Afrofuturism and a lot of like really cool things that imbued it with like what he believes in as a character and for representation. So and with all the gold, I'm just like, is that also like callbacks to the High Republic and stuff like that? So I'm really looking forward to see more of Kylo Ren Beck's character and see like how they flesh that out even further. Like I obviously not maybe not in this show, but maybe like in comic books or novels or something, and see more of this awesome character, because that scene very short when he's like dual wielding lightsabers,
but it was
so
gorgeous.
Cool.
It was so good.
And fun fact, I don't know if you noticed this, but Temuera Morrison was the voice for all the clones.
Oh, yes I did.
So
and
that was dope. Temuera Morrison must be so happy that he accepted being Jango Fett back in the early 2000s, because that is paying off tenfold.
I know.
Tenfold. It's like,
he's still going.
Like, good job, my man. You're a king. But anyway.
And I'm pretty sure we're going to see him in an episode. Boba.
Probably. I mean, it's like, it's all connected. But we could be talking about this episode forever. But so let's talk about the pirate a little bit. What part do we want to talk about the pirate first? Do we want to talk about Nevarro and Gorian Shan, or we want to talk about Carson Teva and the mystery of Moff Gideon? I'll let you decide.
You let me decide?
Yes, you're the birthday girl.
I'm the birthday girl. Okay. let's start with Navarro, because that's where everything began. I love that there's so much circularity to everything. And I think we can start with Navarro and then cut in and then end again with Navarro, as the Mandalorian has done so far.
Yes. Yes.
That's okay with you.
Oh, let's go.
What was the name of the pirate?
Gorian Chand. Although I Gorian still like Chand. To call him a space pirate.
Seaweed spice.
Space plant pirate king. That's my name for him. Like, I know he has an actual name, but.
And I can't believe people are complaining about the character design. I think it's amazing.
Awesome. Awesome. I love it.
It was even better this time, I think. It was just
the minute I fantastic. Saw him, I was like, yes, I just want more of him.
More of you.
Gone too soon. But, oh my God, so good. So good. And his ship looked amazing. Like,
oh God, that Corsair ship was insane. And it looked so good. And the actual firepower capabilities and... You're just, it breaks your fucking heart, because the whole thing is we've seen Navarro as just like this kind of destroyed den of villainy in the first season. And it's slowly been evolving. And at the beginning of the season, it was like this cosmopolitan new place and all these beautiful things and bars in our schools. And then it just gets destroyed in one episode, you know, and just like massively destroyed. So I didn't know they were going to go that hard when that Corsair ship showed and then suddenly it's like massive bombings.
But yeah, but it's interesting because it's the whole thing of the Western hero where like he can never stay because, you know, once you heal the town, like you will bring, you can't heal yourself. So you have to leave. Otherwise,
which
you carry
they
that
did in Bad Batch too, which makes me so sad that we got this like...
We'll talk about Bad Batch later, girl.
Oh, I know.
Pero,
I'm not ready. I don't think I'm ready.
I'm still not ready.
I'm not ready.
So to an extent, that's a reflection of High Magistrate Karga, right? Like he did help heal the town, but then he decides to stay, and him staying to an extent brings like this catastrophe there. So it's and it, again, it's like mythological because we have the threshold, right, that the hero has to cross that we've seen. It was destroyed in Mando season one, and then we see it rebuilt in season two and then improved in season three, but then the threshold is destroyed again. So it's like the journey starts all over again. So I think it's not just a mythic or symbolic representation of Navarro, but like all of the heroes. Like all the heroes to an extent to begin their journeys again, and they have to cross these thresholds, like Joseph Campbell was telling us. So like what better way to talk about those symbols than to make them literal? It's just like, hey, you know that threshold, the threshold that the hero like crossed and then brought the elixir to heal and destroy it,
because
we
have
to do it all over again.
That scene when you see the actual arch at the entrance of Navarro, just like only one side of it was standing. It's so symbolic of what happened to the rest of the town and everything that happened, because they had built that arch way more beautiful than it ever had when the season started. It looked as a symbol as you cross through here, you're in safe lands. To see it broken like that, it's just gorgeous.
And it was like great to see the High Magistrate Karga actually does care about his people, because it's not just like, oh, I'm just the High Magistrate and I care about my title and just like having my little kingdom. Yeah. It's like, no, I actually do care. He had the opportunity to play, and he's like, no, I'm saying so. I'm just like, hey, Apollo Creed, you're doing right by your people. Although I do have a pet peeve. Because of timeline things, and it's just like something that didn't quite make sense to me. We know that Grief Karga sends the distress signal, right, to Carson Teva.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that whole sequence, and we'll get to the whole Carson Teva sequence, but the whole sequence of Carson Teva getting the message, going to the New Republic, and then going back to the Mandalorian covert to get Din to help. I'm just like, that must have taken
a while.
We're talking... At least 2 days. 2 days at least. I don't know how fast hyperspace is, but we're going from the one place to the other to get the meeting with the fucking guy and then going back to the other side to do the thing so that then get them to get organized so that they can come back. And you're like, that took a weekend. That took a weekend at least. So I'm just like, so like for that whole weekend, they were just like staying in the lava flats or whatever the hell they were, probably. But it was a little jarring to me. It's like, oh, this whole attack is happening
really fast.
This whole attack is happening, but then that whole thing happened. But then, like, okay, we're just, I don't know. It was a little weird, but pet peeve. But it's just a pet peeve. It's fine at the end of the day. Like, it's sometimes stories have to move that way to keep the momentum going.
The pacing of the storyline, yeah.
Was it just me? You didn't feel that way at all with, like, that whole sequence?
Now that you mention it, it is. But I didn't feel it at the moment. So I was having just so much fun with this episode.
Oh, no. So... it was great. Don't get me wrong. Like, I loved it. I loved it. But it was just like, okay. That's weird. But let's talk about our boy Carson Teva. So Greef Karga senses a stress signal, and we get it. And we see this New Republic encampment. We see Y-Wings, beautiful Y-Wings. We see parked X-Wings, and it's like, wonderful. And then we go into the, like any military outpost, you have to have a bar. And we see Carson Teva, and all of a sudden we see a group of people to the right, which is actually Rick Famuyiwa, Deborah Chow, and Dave Filoni in a cowboy hat, which, like, I appreciate. The ballsiness of them being like, hey, we're in space, you're wearing the cowboy hat. And it's so poetic to have Dave be where he was sitting, because he's looking across the bar to someone who sits down. Well, actually doesn't sit down. Who stands next to Carson Teva. And it's a Lasat, this purple, giant, hulking person. Stands next to Carson and starts talking to him.
I was like, it can't be.
And I was just like, wait, what? Multiple things were going through my mind. I'm just like, that looks amazing. I was just like, that looks like the
Lasat. And it looks amazing, by the way.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, man, they really, like, did a good job translating what a Lasat looks like from animation into live action. Because it's like, we saw Lasat into almost live action in the sense of Jedi Fallen Order, because Cal Kestis's Jedi Master was a Lasat. So, you know, video games are more realistic. So they did a translation there, and that looked great. But then to see it uber hyper realistic live action was
amazing,
incredible. But then
he starts talking. Voice.
Steve Bloom.
I almost had a heart attack. I could not believe
Carabast.
It.
Carabast. Oh my god, my man Seb. My man Seb is back. How did that feel? Like, first we get Kelleran Beck, which is great. I mean, technically a new. Yeah. Not a really a new character, but a newish character. Still from live action, because we saw him, like I was saying, like in Jedi Temple Challenge. So different type of translation. But how did it feel to you? Because how did it feel to you to see, like, another animated character jump into live action?
I couldn't believe it. I just could not. I mean, I thought I was just already got everything from Animation I was going to get for the season with the Purrgils. I'm like, okay, you did me some solid Rebels. I'm good. Like, you can slowly build up. It's cool. And then Seb. I mean, when you first see him and in his awesome outfit.
Oh, yeah.
Just super chill. And I'm like, no.
They did it.
Me and Wally started screaming like idiots. Went back, watched the scene like 3 times. I can't believe it's Seb. I can't believe it's Seb. I cannot believe they actually did this. I was so happy.
It was a moment. It was a moment.
I was never expecting it either. No. Like, even a little bit.
And it's the type of character that makes sense for a scene like that.
Yes.
So
yes,
it's,
it does.
And it works because not only does it make sense for that character to kind of be there? But also, if you're a fan that doesn't watch the animated things or just a casual Star Wars fan, it doesn't distract for you. It's just like, it's just a character, right? That you're talking about.
Character.
So you don't need to know about the context to enjoy the scene. It doesn't take you out of it. You know, it's not a cameo. Right. It's like, whoa, what?
Like, who is this person? This? What should I know? I can't understand what's happening.
But
it's a completely understandable conversation. You don't need any background to understand what's happening in the scene. But like you were saying, for the rest of us.
It's like, oh my God. And so does that mean, a little responsible speculation here, does that mean that he's going to be in Ahsoka? He has to, right? Like, why would you spend so much money Oh, you spend so much money to building that digital character.
The creature, yeah.
If you're not going to reuse it, you know, it's kind of... Well, we'll find out on Friday. On Friday, Star Wars Celebration at the Ahsoka panel. If I'm able to get in, we'll see. Because there's going to be a trailer. There has to be a trailer.
There has to be. And at this point, I'm really hoping that what we've talked about before, that they were kind of trying to add all those animated characters into Mando to see how they worked, because Mando is super popular already, mm-hmm. and see how it worked. And if it was successful, which I think they are being very successful with it, we're going to get more.
Yeah, I think, but it's funny because for me, like, this feels a little bit like Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, and hear me out, not in the sense that it's Guardians of the Galaxy, in the sense that before Guardians of the Galaxy and Marvel was doing the MCU, they were very cautious about what characters are putting out there.
And you couldn't be
like,
weird.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just like, hey, Iron Man, Captain America, mm-hmm. Thor, like all the, you know, the usual suspects that, you know, people are going to know.
And then suddenly...
And then Guardians of the Galaxy, exactly. Then then let's do Guardians of the Galaxy. Let's check this out. Like, it's a, you know, if you're a comic book nerd, you know them. I never knew them because I was never into the comic books. But it was a movie that was like, when I remember when it was announced, I'm like, what the hell is this?
Who are these people?
Like, I have no idea what this is. And then I saw the movie and I loved it. And I feel like that movie is like, okay, we can go into obscure characters and go weird, and people will embrace it as long as we have good stories. And I feel like this is a little bit that. Let's just say, okay, let's see what we can put in.
Purgle, Seb, and then start.
And now it's like, oh, okay, well, it works. So let's just go all 100% into Star Wars weirdness. And I am on the train. I was already on the train. But now I got the VIP pass on the train. I'm at the front row, ready to be given everything that they want to give me, because it's beautiful. Like, people that say that Star Wars is dead, or that like Disney Star Wars is horrible,
they need serious reevaluation.
It's just
or
like
just stop.
It's just like, exactly, like, if you're not enjoying it, that's fine, but like, this is we're getting everything, man.
Oh,
everything.
Seb.
And we don't have
Seb,
to choose.
Did you ever think you were going to get Seb in live action? Ever?
No.
Exactly.
I didn't expect that he would be in Ahsoka. I mean, it's like, that's too much of a difficult character to pull off in live action. So probably not. But, and he looked incredible. Like, it was like so, because keep in mind, this is a TV show.
Right.
This is not a movie budget. I mean, obviously the Mandalorian's budget is pretty good, but it's not movie budget.
Yeah.
And to have like that type of like digital character look that amazing, it's just like, oh my God.
Oh yeah.
I was
blown away.
I'm ready for everything.
If it wasn't for the fact that that episode could have been complete crap and I would have loved it just because of that scene.
Yeah.
And then you add the fact that the episode was fucking amazing. It just elevates the fact that, Seb was just kind of a bonus because the episode was insanely good.
Exactly. But we could be talking for forever about Seb, but unfortunately we have to other parts of the episode. But after that beautiful, extremely appropriate cameo from Seb concludes, we see Carson Teva go to the New Republic and talk to, I forgot the actor's name, but it was great that like he was in that
scene.
One
from SNL?
Yeah.
I could just imagine here with like the Chevalier of whatever he was.
Yeah,
do you remember his character from SNL?
I don't remember the name, but I remember his kids.
But
it was so good, that scene, because it kind of further cements the failure of the New Republic and why they were not an effective government, because, you know, they are so afraid to doing anything that is even remotely similar to the Empire that they kind of handicapped themselves.
It just went straight bureaucracy, and it's all like paperwork and forms, and this is all the things I can do, and that's it.
Yeah, it's
departments
like
within departments with the departments, and it just doesn't work.
Kind of sounds similar, right, to the world we live in. But hey, Star Wars is not political.
Of course, it never has been.
And then Katie O'Brien, in a wonderful scene stealing performance, just comes in to be very imperial in everything that she's saying.
I know.
And somehow actually convince the New Republic that her imperial perspective it's actually not it's that okay. bad. It's okay. Like, we should do it that way. And you can see Carson Tevas like signals going off.
Like, right what?
Now. So what did you? What did
all
you
the
think
red flags.
What you think of all that? Like, in terms of like what, how they were presenting the New Republic, and then Katie's, you know.
I mean, in the glimpses that we have had of the New Republic, because we don't really get that much about them in the sequel trilogy, because, you know, they literally get blown up in the first movie. So,
unfortunately.
But during The Mandalorian, we've seen a lot already of hints of how this is just not working, because they kept a lot of the same structures. They didn't try to implement change. The aristocrats were still the same ones regardless, and there's no empathy, and they were too probably lenient in how they accepted and who they accepted back into the Republic under like the auspices of I've changed, I found the light,
the which, amnesty
which Katie's
program.
So great at twisting that. It's like, oh, but you were captured. I wasn't captured. I was liberated, you know, and playing that side, it's like, It makes the Republic feel like, yeah.
She knows what Republic, words to say.
We are heroes. We liberated you. We enlightened you. We set you on the correct path. And they're so convinced of their rightness, which is the same thing that was wrong with the Empire. They're so convinced of their rightness that they're not willing to see the flaws in everything that's happening. I mean, one of the four things about the rebellion was that we want to try to save the people. And they come asking for aid for people. Oh yeah, they're not part of the member chart.
Right. It's like, what's the point of like being liberators if you're not going to help the people that need help?
If only the people that fall under your regime are the ones that get your assistance. It's the same thing that the Empire did. So starting to see it just like destroy itself from within, even before they got blown up, it's kind of satisfying to see a little bit, because it's like, yeah, you kind of deserve to get shot because you suck.
Right.
But it's also terrifying to see that, I mean, they went through so much to liberate themselves from the Empire, but it's always a cycle. If there's nobody actually willing to change for the better, it's just a new empire with a different name. And it just foments like the New Order. The First Order was growing under their noses the whole time.
Right. It's a demilitarized and polite empire, because now people don't backstab each other anymore.
Right.
Now they're nice, but they still suck.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, you don't get any benefits of aid if you don't follow all of I mean, it's ridiculous. It's the Empire with another name. And that's why it was so easy to let them get destroyed and have the First Order rise so easily. So I feel like there was barely a pause in Palpatine's plans at this point. It's like, oh.
Palpatine's got the plans on top of plans. Like, you can't mess with him. But so good, because again, like we've been saying before, season 3 just keeps building on top of itself to like some culmination, which we'll get to it like at the final segment of the episode when we do our responsible speculation. But it feels like there's going to be some catharsis and so an explosion of events that will lead into season 4. Because I don't think that things will be resolved in season 3. I think season 3 is a catalyst for what's coming, especially with Ahsoka up in the horizon. But we see then Carson Teva go back and be like, well, if I'm not getting help from the people that are supposed to help, let's see if like people like the Mandalorians are gonna help. And if the Mandalorians accept, right, then it's just like, well, it should help. And then they do. Which I think like that whole sequence is fun, and we talked about it a little bit. But for me, like the most interesting part of the Carson Teva arc is how it culminates then when he discovers the Lambda class shuttle that was transporting Moff Gideon. How did you feel about that?
I knew it was coming.
Like that? Like exactly how it happened?
Not how it happened, but that Moff Gideon definitely escaped. Like I knew Moff Gideon had escaped.
Oh, yeah. We knew that. They had already said it. Yeah.
Because he was like, I know he didn't make it to trial. I mean, when he first see the Imperial ship like at a distance, I was like, oh, they're gonna kill him. He said goodbye. And then you see that it's actually like a destroyed ship. And it's amazing how they start to figure out what's going on. He's dead. Obviously, the fact that they found Mandalorian armor inside makes me question everything that's happening. Like, why would Mandalorians aid Moff Gideon? The Empire is the one that destroyed Mandalore. This is known.
Do you think that that's a red herring?
I don't know. It could be. Because I feel like just leaving Beskar on a ship, like...
It's too obvious, why? Right? It's sloppy.
Yeah. So, and it's really hard to have a piece of Beskar armor just like randomly fall off and land somewhere. Exactly. So it could be part of Moff Gideon knowing that the Mandalorians are probably a threat, and the fact that Din has the Darksaber, and just to throw hate towards the Mandalorian by planting the seed of doubt. It could be that. But there's still a lot of... I never really know what the armor is thinking. So I still have a lot of doubts of what's going on, and how she's manipulating Bo, I don't like. And she's really hypocritical because it's very extreme towards Din. It's like, oh, you removed your helmet, you're an apostate. With Bo-Katan, it's, oh, she walks both worlds. So we can suspend the rules for her in a place where there's no suspension of rules. Like, and that's obviously a power move because she knows that there's no way that she's going to reunite all Mandalorians if they're all under her creed. That no helmets, all these things, whatever, whatever. And she obviously saw Bo as a bridge. So she encouraged her to, you know, be herself, remove her helmet. So she would be more convincing. Oh, look, they're not as insane as you thought. Right. Join us. I'm their ambassador, you know, but it's still very convenient for the armor, you know?
But I don't know if that means that she is involved with Moff Gideon's escape. I don't know. I mean, in that whole sequence, I have to say, like, that whole sequence was beautifully shot. Like, it was incredible when you see, like, the art, the astromech unit. Like, detach thing and do the scanning.
And it feels like you're underwater gorgeous. At the same time that you're
It's like a combination
of that, which like is really cool.
The abyss mixed with Alien. It's like, so good. The vibe.
And you have all the tension immaculate. Because you can only see certain, like, wherever the light touches is that you can actually see what's going on. So there's so much tension. Like, what are you actually going to get to
right,
see?
Right, right, right. It felt like Titanic, right? Like the first scene from Titanic when they're sending the probe down to scout the wreckage of the ship. And you can only see exactly what the flashlight of the rover is looking at. So in that sense, it's very akin to that. So like, I loved how that scene looked. It was beautiful. But I think it might be a red herring just because, I mean, it does make sense to an extent that there are, because we know from Rebels that there are Mandalorians that were aligned with the Empire. Yeah. Although I don't know if that's enough to justify them still being part of like the Imperial remnants, because like the Empire the Empire destroyed your home. I think that would be enough for you to be like, maybe these guys are the bad guys.
I'm done.
Maybe you're the bad guys. Maybe I need to get the hell out of here. Although I've always had this theory. And one of my theories was that like Moff Gideon is Mandalorian or was Mandalorian a long time ago. So like, I think that it's plausible that like he knows what strings to pull to be able to antagonize them or get them to appear to be the enemy or get them riled up or do something that's going to get them in the crosshairs of either the new Republic or whatever enemies that they're facing off now, like the Pirate King. So I think that
like through a common enemy, just bringing them all together or something.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. So I think that that's they're playing a con game.
That wouldn't be.
Because we know that Moff Gideon has Beskar, right? In season one, the client had it. So, but I think by extension, Moff Gideon.
Yeah, but he had, and he could wield the Darksaber. Like, he could actually wield it.
So, I don't know. I don't think the Mandalorian. I mean, it'd be interesting to see like Mandos fighting Mandos. But I think it's a red herring. I think it's a way to frame them so that they're more on the run and the New Republic has to like take action against them.
Which is also what the armor's been trying to do. She's trying to keep them isolated and hidden, and what Din accomplished now by having them come out in the open. I think that's when the armor maybe started to have to like switch gears and decide to go a different way. And that's why she like recruited Bo-Katan now, because she knows she's losing control.
Mm-mm.
Because it's way easier to control people when you're hiding in a cave than when you're giving them land and giving them community and having them have actual lives beyond the covert.
Right. When they can see other points of view and other people and interact with them and be sympathetic to them and be like, oh, maybe there are other ways instead of like the one thing that I'm being told over and over again. It's a good point. It's a good point. Mm-hmm. We'll see. But we did a little bit of responsible speculation, but let's do a little bit more. We have, obviously, releasing this episode very late. So episode 20, chapter 22, whatever. The next episode comes out the day after we put this out. So we'll have answers a little sooner for like our
than usual
speculation. But Nanny, what do you think we're going to see in the next episode?
I think we're going to see Bo-Katan trying to get recruits. Maybe we're going to see more Mandalorians. I mean, that's a possibility. I don't know. I mean, how amazing was it to see them fighting as a unit in Navarro? That entire sequence of them fighting was so incredible. I still get goosebumps thinking about
it. A live action Clone Wars episode.
I know. It was so good. That's what Cosmando was exactly. Oh, live action Clone Wars. It's so good. It's so good. It's amazing. So I think we might get some of that. I think we're going to get something maybe more Din-centric, because I think we haven't...
Yeah, he's taking the back seat a little bit.
Of the parts, which is good, because in season two, it wasn't just that he was like kind of taking a back seat. It was sometimes he was like excluded altogether and you didn't see where it fit. This feels a little bit more like just complimentary to everything that happens. And you always know that Din's there and you always know that Grogu's there, but they're trying to see like what community they're coming into, I feel like. So I think maybe we'll get a more Din-centered episode. I still really enjoy when we get perspectives from the Empire. So I'm always all for all of that. I want to see what Katie O'Brien is really up to. I want to see Moff Gideon.
That's what I was going to say, that maybe we'll see him finally like in the next episode, because there's only three episodes left. So I don't know if this is going to be a bait and switch. One of the things that people online have been saying is that Moff is playing like a larger game, which, I mean, to an extent, yes, true, because I think that there's something going on with him and the beginnings of the First Order.
To the Mandalorians, so there could be...
Right, but other people have been saying that, like, he's working for Thrawn, because, you know, we have to connect this to the Ahsoka show to some extent.
We don't have to.
There's already a lot of connections there.
I don't want that.
I don't want that because, and this is because, you know, everyone that's watching video can see that I got Thrawn right up there. I like Thrawn a lot, especially his characterization in the current books by Timothy Zahn, where you can kind of see that he's more of an anti-villain than a straight up villain. So I'm really hoping that that Thrawn isn't, you know, a straight up villain, Ahsoka. I hope that he actually turns out to be an ally, because if you read the books, Thrawn only joined the Empire so that he can have a strong enough ally to protect the Shiss Ascendancy, which is where he comes from any external threats that could that he foresees is going to attack them. So in a way, he's not really supporting the Empire. For him, it's a practical move. It's like, I need to be with the Empire because they're going to help me when the time is right to protect the Shiss Ascendancy. So in a way, he's not a villain in the traditional sense where like, oh, I'm a bad guy and I want to blow up good guys. So I hope that they keep that characterization going through the Ahsoka show, and that he ends up kind of flipping, because he's not flipping in the traditional sense, if you know what I'm saying. So I don't want him to all of a sudden be like, I'm actually the big bad guy, because that'll be boring, at least to me.
Especially if you get the characterization that we left him with in Rebels, and now he's probably been stuck with Ezra.
Right.
So, they're best friends. It would make sense that,
they're best friends now. Come on. But that's just me. That's just me, because I want I want good boy Thrawn. call me naive, but I want good boy Thrawn. I want to see what that's like. Besties with Ezra just playing beach volleyball somewhere, shirtless, Top Gun style. Do it. If you put Seb in live action, you could put a shirtless volleyball scene. Do it right now. But that's it. See, I always have to end up. I always have to end up end episodes with a weird, awkward note. But some people appreciate that. Thank you, everyone in the comments. You know who you are.
So anyway, we won't be recording for a little bit this time officially, because we are going to Star Wars Celebration.
I'm going to be in Great Britain, in England.
It's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
We're going to try to release our thoughts on some of the Bat Batch before London happens. We're going to try, because I don't know if I'm emotionally ready to talk about what happened.
Oh, I'm still destroyed. Stop.
By the way, Wally blames it on us because we started the Deadpool and we jinxed it. And it's our fault.
It's not. Yep. I did not put pen to paper. I was not the writer of that episode.
Horrible. Crying like a little baby. Yeah, I'm not ready.
We saw it coming. It was the obvious choice, even though we wanted it to be someone else. But we'll talk about that in another. This episode's about Mandalorian joy. Yeah.
So on that note, thank you so much for joining. I'd remember to like, subscribe, comment, let us know what's going on. If you're going to London Star Wars Celebration,
say hi.
Give us a hi. I'm not going to be there, but Goose will.
I got stickers. Say hi, please.
It's going to be great. And our stickers are super cool.
They're pretty cool, yeah. And these ones are special Star Wars Celebration exclusive ones that say SWCE23. So you can only get them at Star Wars Celebration, because I will burn them if I have any left, so that they are actually exclusive.
Wow. En serio. Okay. Yeah. So we are looking forward to many, many good things. The people who can't make it, I'm pretty sure we're going to be able to see a lot of the things live. And happy Easter to everybody. We love you. We will be back. Until next time, may the Force be with you.